Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationship with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us for the first part of the show is Alice Hill. Alice is a senior fellow for climate change policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's also the co-author of the new book, Building a Resilient Tomorrow: How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. Alice, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with Nell and myself this morning on This Green Earth.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to join you.
Yeah, we have so much. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
We got lots of questions, but I thought we'd start off with just getting a nice working definition of what resilient and what resiliency means, because there's quite a umbrella of terms that go along with it.
Well, that's a great question, because certainly there are a lot of definitions out there about resilience. For our book, Leo Martinez and I chose the definition of reducing, absorbing, and recovering from the impacts of climate change. And we chose to use the word in relation to climate impacts because that is a future risk that often is not incorporated in current decision-making.
Okay, so I was thinking about resiliency in that term, in those sense that when, let's say when people first moved west, to the American West, they had to adapt acts of resiliency to combat the living in the West, in a warm and dry West. And I guess one example of resiliency here is building reservoirs, let's say, but not just building a reservoir that would hold like 1 week or 1 month's worth of water. They had to think long term, in a sense, and they had to build reservoirs or water tanks that could allow them to make it through an entire dry season and maybe even beyond. So is that kind of an example of resiliency in that way?
Sure. That's planning ahead for a known risk that there would be a drought and that they would need to stockpile water. I think what's different about climate change and what has made it so hard for communities to adjust to is that it's about a future risk. Mm-hmm. And almost all of our decision making has been based on historical observations of the types of extremes that we've experienced in the past. All of our building codes, for example, our land use decisions rest on assumptions regarding what the extremes will look like. And those assumptions are based on the past extremes we've experienced. But with climate change, the extremes are going to get worse, and they're going to come more quickly. And we just don't have the mindset yet to incorporate that different lens in our view of risk.
So tell us a little bit about the decision to focus your work and to focus the book on resiliency rather than on, you know, prevention of climate change, which is where so much of the conversation is right now.
Absolutely. We need to cut our emissions, no question. Mm-hmm. In my mind, my co-author's mind, anyone who works on resilience recognizes that we must cut our emissions. That's the best resilience policy there is. But climate change is here. It is deeply affecting communities already. It threatens public health, it threatens local economies, and it threatens our national security. So we need to take steps now that will keep us safer in the future. Studies tell us that if we spend a dollar now to mitigate against the risk of climate change, prepare for climate change, it can save us anywhere up to $6, $12 in recovery. So that'll keep us economically strong and also mean that people suffer less trauma.
Right. But to circle back, you alluded to perhaps some reasons for inaction, you know, why people are reluctant to want to spend that dollar, let's say, knowing that, like you say, we could save $6 or $7 down the road. And let's talk about some of the reasons behind inaction.
Well, part of the reason is simply there's a lot of political noise around this. So mm-hmm. for politicians to argue to their constituents, let's spend $10 million on a higher bridge because we think we'll have future flooding versus $10 million on greater crime prevention or greater investment in our schools is a difficult argument.
Mm-hmm.
But also, people, we all suffer from an availability bias. We tend to judge our risk based on either what we or our friends have experienced in the past. And with climate change, the past will not resemble the future. We will have more extremes. So until a community or even a person has suffered one of the impacts of climate change, they may not really believe simply because that's the way our minds assess risk. We base it on what we personally experienced. And that's what behavioral economists tell us. That's what social science tells us. So we're working against our human nature to contemplate the risks from climate change.
Yeah, you talk about no more moments in that sense, that
yeah.
Sometimes it takes a big event, catastrophic event, to change people's minds and attitudes.
Yes, and we see that. You can almost look at any major event after Hurricane Sandy. New York City doubled down on climate preparedness. They've invested about $19 billion since that event occurred 7 years ago. That was their no more moment. They weren't going to see that kind of flooding again and not be so prepared. And that flooding, by the way, was partially as a result of the city's failure to account for the about a foot of sea level rise it had experienced since 1900. And so all of its storm barriers were simply too low for the type of storm surge that came with Sandy. Similarly, in Houston, after Harvey dumped 4 feet of rain on this flat city that had really forsworn any building codes, the people of Houston said, we can't have this again, and they now have a strong building code. They've issued a bond to have greater flood mitigation. They've taken advantage of that no more moment where they realized we can't be this vulnerable again and continue to thrive as a community.
So we know that sort of preparing for this changing climate economically makes sense to do, you know, right now, as you talked about, and that it impacts us in so many ways. So let's talk about a few of the examples that you share in the book. You know, when we talk about how a change in climate is going to impact human health, kind of share with us an example from the book about that.
Well, we know that with greater heat, we see some very negative impacts. You know, heat is the greatest killer, and we've seen communities be repeatedly surprised. In 2003, France had its no more moment when it saw massive deaths, excess deaths is what we call them, as a result of a heat wave, and they swore that they would never have that happen again, and they have are one of the leaders in heat preparedness. Montreal this summer, Canada, doesn't have a lot of air conditioning and hasn't seen a lot of heat waves. They had a terrible heat wave, and they had over 80 deaths as a result of that heat wave. We've learned a lot about who dies in heat waves. It's often the socially isolated, and that was true in Montreal. That's been true in Chicago. So we need to build resilience, both to reduce the impacts of the heat, air conditioning centers, having green environments within our cities that can reduce the actual heat island effect. If you have a lot of buildings and asphalt, it's very hot, but if you have trees and green spaces, you can cool things down. So if you can take measures now to reduce the impact of the heat, plus do some social networking or community building so that those who are the most isolated will have someone check on them, will have a much better outcome in the future.
Right. That you mentioned those examples of green infrastructure that communities can adopt and use what's called green bonds to fund them. Talk a little bit about green bonds.
Green bonds have taken off in recent years. They're a way of attracting investments that are viewed as more socially responsible and certainly environmentally responsible. We also have seen resilience bonds that have allowed communities to raise money to make investments. For example, Miami issued a $400 million forever bond, which was designed to help it with its sea level rise issues. These are important instruments for raising the type of money that we need to prepare for these kinds of impacts, and we've seen communities really embrace them. It would be great if we took some of the savings, if we get a carbon tax, and also pour those into resilience, because ultimately those will allow us, that investment will allow communities to be safer.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Alice Hill. Alice is a senior fellow for climate change policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's the co-author of a new book titled Building a Resilient Tomorrow, How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption, and her co-author is Leonardo Martinez Diaz. That's interesting you mentioned Miami, because that forever bond was, I believe, supported or forwarded under a mayor who was first reluctant to take any movement with respect to climate change and rising seas down in South Florida. That's a big sticky issue, going all the way back to those biases you talked about, convincing people who are otherwise feel it's not worth it to spend money today to build resiliency, tomorrow and beyond. That's a tough ask to try to get voters to approve big, robust bonds like that.
Absolutely, and this was a Republican mayor.
Yeah.
In Florida, they've sometimes not favored the use of the term climate change. Mm. But because the impacts are so visible there now, they're getting what we call sunny day flooding, mm-hmm. where just because of high tides, there's floodwaters in the streets. The community has begun to rally around finding solutions for the city. I'd say that they are still hopeful that the city will somehow be able to stem the tide of sea level rise, but really the projections are quite grim for Miami, and as of yet there are no long-term solutions. So what that bond does is buy time. It builds more pumps, it protects more areas with seawalls or whatever until the city can come to terms with what choices it needs to make with rapidly rising seas later in the century.
So you were special assistant to President Barack Obama and senior director for resilience policy on the National Security Council. And you focused on kind of climate change and climate resilience. And you share a story in the book about when you were in that role and you ended up speaking with the town of Norfolk, Virginia, who had installed some major, major infrastructure, and the impacts of sea level rise and climate change had not been taken into account in the creation of this. And would you share that story with us, and then also share, are people starting to take this into account more proactively than they were maybe 10 years ago?
Sure. Norfolk is just a ground zero, really, for climate change, because it has so many assets, military installations that are critical for the United States security. It has the largest naval base in the world. It has the strategic headquarters of NATO is there, as well as other areas in the globe. We also have facilities to build nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers. So a lot of military interest in the survival of this area, but it faces sea level rise at a rate twice the global average, and plus the land is subsiding. So it's just a chronic issue of flooding for them, and will increase dramatically in the coming years. It's also has the sunny day flooding, where just tidal flooding, it's bright, it's sunny outside, now happens about at least 10 days a year, and residents report that at least one day a year they can't even get out of their neighborhoods because of flooding.
Wow.
Well, it turns out 90% of the people who work on these military installations live off base, so they need to have some means to get to the base. And my second day in the White House, I'm invited to a meeting, and the Norfolk City manager is there, really, with his hat in hand, saying, "You must help us. We have just finished building this light rail system, which is aptly named the Tide, but the system didn't account for sea level rise. And so it's already vulnerable to sunny day flooding. And as it sees disruptions in its service, that means personnel won't get to the bases, which ultimately can impact our national security." And that is a national security risk. It affects our operational and military readiness if personnel are either can't get to the facilities or can't have their families taken care of. So we need to make sure that we are making the proper investment. And to your question, unfortunately, we don't see this systematically included. I'd say the vast majority of infrastructure being built in the United States does not account for future impacts from climate change. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but one of the basic ones is we don't have a building code that does that, and we have no sort of template for how it's done. So it typically does not occur, and then our cost-benefit analysis does not take into account long-term risk.
Right.
So it tends to discount the value of investing that one extra dollar to get the $6 return. So we continue to have many examples of things that in hindsight look really not so smart,
right,
as Norfolk was alerting us to.
So let's talk a little bit about the building code that you mentioned, because in the U.S. that tends to be, you know, a pretty made on a micro scale, you know, at this like local and state level. And but that's not the case everywhere else. And so that does that inhibit kind of our ability as a nation to adapt or anticipate these changes?
Well, we have a different system than most developed countries. We have a private entity called the International Code Council, as well as a few other code councils. But the ICC is the primary developer of codes. They develop model codes, and then either state or local governments, depending on how the state has decided to approach the issue, adopt portions of that model code or don't adopt at all and don't have any code. What this has meant is that because of this patchwork adoption of codes, we have communities that are very vulnerable. Houston was an example of that. It really was not in favor of building codes. They wanted to build as develop as much as they could so they could get the tax revenues and have a thriving, growing city. But by not using a building code, they became very vulnerable to flooding. So there is no national building code, and really constitutionally, I don't think we would get to a national building code. One sound way to approach this is what the Obama administration did in saying, well, if you want to take the federal taxpayer money, Houston or any other city, and use that money to build, if you're going to build in or near a floodplain, you need to at least elevate the structure. That's a very basic risk mitigation for flood, is simply to raise the structure by a couple of feet so the water can wash underneath. And that's what the Obama administration did. Unfortunately, 10 days before Harvey hit, President Trump decided to rescind that order, and there is no current national standard for taking taxpayer money and building in risky areas. That needs to change because what happens is the communities decide to build in a risky manner, either in a risky place or with no building code or both, and then the bad thing happens, a terrible event happens, everyone is hurting, and these communities are deeply suffering, and so the federal government comes in and bails them out. But the problem, of course, is that these bailouts are growing exponentially to the point where the watchdog for the Congress, the Government Accountability Office, has said this is a high risk to our federal treasury to continue these bailouts for communities that are not taking any action to prevent or reduce the risk from climate impacts.
We only have a few more minutes. I want to talk about another really sticky issue, and that's the concept of retreat. We've talked about this in the past, that there at some point you can have insurance companies and come to the rescue and help you rebuild, or the federal government will help subsidize you rebuilding your home somewhere. But at some point, a decision has to be made, perhaps by the local governments or so, to say, you can't live here anymore. And that is a difficult ask of a property owner, to give up their property. But that's going to happen, or I see that coming too.
Oh, I think that we're going to have retreat, whether we go willingly or not, because literally the land will disappear when you're talking about coastal communities. It just will slip into the ocean. And then some of this riverine or the property that gets regularly flooded will be so soggy that it will be just intolerable to live on it. But the term managed retreat has almost become a dirty word in some communities. We've seen a lot of hostility towards it. For example, in California, a very affluent community, Del Mar, was instructed, as all coastal communities were instructed along California's coast, to consider managed retreat. That is a plan for how you move the city back, the infrastructure, the roads, the piping, as the sea levels rise and land is eroded away. And the town council took up the issue. The townspeople revolted and said, we don't want to talk about managed retreat. It will hurt our property values, which is probably true that it would hurt the property values. But the property values are going to be going down anyway, certainly for those who are at risk of losing their home. So they're at a stalemate. But interesting, in Norfolk, where we have seen they are desperately facing some really dire situations, a Republican mayor there claims to be the first mayor in the United States to publicly talk about retreat, and they are beginning to move some communities inland. It's a very difficult process, and it's very dependent on many factors. The bottom line, just as we have an availability bias, we are all, it turns out, many of us are very emotionally attached to our homes and our communities, and it's hard for people to realize they might have to move.
Yeah, human nature is the could be right. some of the biggest the biggest obstacle to addressing resiliency. And you talk about those concepts and ideas: availability bias, optimism bias, loss aversion is an interesting one too. It's fascinating. The name of the book again is Building a Resilient Tomorrow: How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. It talks about, like we talked a little, touched on how bonds can help address resiliency, how private businesses, for-profit businesses can help. The real estate industry is going to play a big role. The insurance industry, of course, other taxes and bonds. And human behavior has to change, though. And the way we look at where we live and how we live is going to be a big role, play a big role in resiliency. And it's all here in the book. It's wonderful because at the end of each chapter, there's prescriptions and summaries about and provocations that highlight the discussions. It's a great read, Alice. Thank you so much for writing this. And hey, where can people go to learn more about maybe what you and Leonardo are working on now or in the future? Do you have a website?
I have a website, AliceHillResilience.com. It has all my writing, other than the book, on the website. And Leo Martinez is at the World Resources Institute, WRI, and he's head of finance there, and they have done some tremendous work looking at how communities as well as nation states can better finance these enormous costs that are coming our way as a result of climate change.
All right. Alice Hill, Senior Fellow for Climate Change Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks again so much for joining us this morning.